Dewey imagines it must have been Nancy. He'd often theorized, on the basis of the gold wristwatch found tucked in the toe of a shoe in her closet, that Nancy had awakened, heard persons in the house, thought they might be thieves, and prudently hidden the watch, her most valuable property. For all I knew, maybe it was somebody with a gun. But Dick wouldn't even listen to me. He was so busy playing tough boy, bossing Mr. Clutter around. Now he'd brought him back to the bedroom. He was counting the money in Mr. Clutter's billfold. There was about $30. He threw the billfold on the bed and told him, "You've got more money in this house than that. A rich man like you, living on a spread like this?" Mr. Clutter said that was all the cash he had, and explained he always did business by check. He offered to write us a check. Dick just blew up. "What kind of Mongolians do you think we are?" And I thought Dick was ready to smash him, so I said, "Dick, listen to me. There's somebody awake upstairs." Mr. Clutter told us the only people upstairs were his wife and his son and daughter. Dick wanted to know if the wife had any money, and Mr. Clutter said if she did, it would be very little. A few dollars. And he asked us, really kind of broke down, please not to bother her, because she was an invalid. She'd been very ill for a long time. But Dick insisted on going upstairs. He made Mr. Clutter lead the way. At the foot of the stairs, Mr. Clutter switched on lights that lighted the hall above, and as we were going up, he said, "I don't know why you boys want to do this. I've never done you any harm. I never saw you before." That's when Dick told him, "Shut up. When we want you to talk, we'll tell you." Wasn't anybody in the upstairs hall, and all the doors were shut. Mr. Clutter pointed out the rooms where the boy and girl were supposed to be sleeping, then opened his wife's door. He lighted a lamp beside the bed and told her, "It's all right, sweetheart. Don't be afraid. These men, they just want some money." She was a thin, frail sort of woman in a long white nightgown. The minute she opened her eyes, she started to cry. She says, talking to her husband, "Sweetheart, I don't have any money." He was holding her hand, patting it. He said, "Now don't cry, honey. It's nothing to be afraid of. It's just I gave these men all the money I had, but they want some more. They believe we have a safe somewhere in the house. I told them we don't." Dick raised his hand, like he was going to crack him across the mouth. Says, "Didn't I tell you to shut up?" Mrs. Clutter said, "But my husband's telling you the God's truth. There isn't any safe." And Dick answers back, "I know goddamn well you got a safe, and I'll find it before I leave here. Needn't worry that I won't." Then he asked her where she kept her purse. The purse was in a bureau drawer. Dick turned it inside out, found just some change and a dollar or two. I motioned to him to come into the hall. I wanted to discuss the situation. So we stepped outside and I said, Dunce interrupts him to ask if Mr. and Mrs. Clutter could overhear the conversation. No. We were just outside the door, where we could keep an eye on them. But we were whispering. I told Dick, "These people are telling the truth. The one who lied is your friend Floyd Wells. There isn't any safe, so let's get the hell out of here." But Dick was too ashamed to face it. He said he wouldn't believe it till we searched the whole house. He said the thing to do was tie them all up, then take our time looking around. You couldn't argue with him. He was so excited. The glory of having everybody at his mercy. That's what excited him. Well, there was a bathroom next door to Mrs. Clutter's room. The idea was to lock the parents in the bathroom and wake the kids and put them there, then bring them out one by one and tie them up in different parts of the house. And then, says Dick, after we've found the safe, we'll cut their throats. Can't shoot them, he says. That would make too much noise. Perry frowns, rubs his knees with his manacled hands. Let me think a minute. Because along in here, things begin to get a little complicated. I remember. Yes. Yes, I took a chair out of the hall and stuck it in the bathroom, so Mrs. Clutter could sit down, seeing she was said to be an invalid. When we locked them up, Mrs. Clutter was crying and telling us, "Please don't hurt anybody. Please don't hurt my children." And her husband had his arms around her, saying, like, "Sweetheart, these fellows don't mean to hurt anybody. All they want is some money." We went to the boys' room. He was awake, lying there like he was too scared to move. Dick told him to get up, but he didn't move, or move fast enough, so Dick punched him, pulled him out of bed, and I said, "You don't have to hit him, Dick." And I told the boy, he was only wearing a t-shirt, to put on his pants. He put on a pair of blue jeans, and we'd just locked him in the bathroom when the girl appeared. Came out of her room. She was all dressed, like she'd been awake some while. I mean, she had on socks and slippers, and a kimono, and her hair was wrapped in a bandana. She was trying to smile. She said, "Good grief, what is this? Some kind of joke?" I don't guess she thought it was much of a joke, though. Not after Dick opened the bathroom door and shoved her in. Dewey envisions them. The captive family, meek and frightened, but without any premonition of their destiny. Herb couldn't have suspected, or he would have fought. He was a gentleman, but strong and no coward. Herb, his friend Alvin Dewey, felt certain would have fought to the death defending Bonnie's life and the lives of his children. Dick stood guard outside the bathroom door while I reconnoitered. I frisked the girls' room, and I found a little purse, like a doll's purse. Inside it was a silver dollar. I dropped it somehow, and it rolled across the floor. Rolled under a chair. I had to get down on my knees. And just then it was like I was outside myself, watching myself in some nutty movie. It made me sick. I was just disgusted. Dick, and all his talk about a rich man's safe, and here I am crawling on my belly to steal a child's silver dollar. $1. And I'm crawling on my belly to get it. Perry squeezes his knees, asks the detectives for aspirin, thanks Dunce for giving him one, chews it, and resumes talking. But that's what you do. You get what you can. I frisked the boys' room, too. Not a dime. But there was a little portable radio, and I decided to take it. Then I remembered the binoculars I'd seen in Mr. Clutter's office. I went downstairs to get them. I carried the binoculars and the radio out to the car. It was cold, and the wind and the cold felt good. The moon was so bright you could see for miles. And I thought, why don't I walk off? Walk to the highway. Hitch a ride. I sure Jesus didn't want to go back in that house. And yet, how can I explain this? It was like I wasn't part of it. More as though I was reading a story. And I had to know what was going to happen. The end. So I went back upstairs. And now let's see. That's when we tied them up. Mr. Clutter first. We called him out of the bathroom and I tied his hands together. Then I marched him all the way down to the basement. Dewey says, "Alone and unarmed?" I had the knife. Dewey says, "But Hickok stayed guard upstairs?" To keep them quiet. Anyway, I didn't need help. I've worked with rope all my life. Dewey says, "Were you using the flashlight or did you turn on the basement lights?" The lights. The basement was divided into two sections. One part seemed to be a playroom. Took him to the other section, the furnace room. I saw a big cardboard box leaning against the wall. A mattress box. Well, I didn't feel I ought to ask him to stretch out on the cold floor. So I dragged the mattress box over, flattened it, and told him to lie down. The driver, via the rearview mirror, glances at his colleague, attracts his eye, and Dunce slightly nods, as if in tribute. All along, Dewey had argued that the mattress box had been placed on the floor for the comfort of Mr. Clutter, and taking heed of similar hints, other fragmentary indications of ironic, erratic compassion, the detective had conjectured that at least one of the killers was not altogether uncharitable. I tied his feet, then tied his hands to his feet. I asked him, was it too tight, and he said no, but said, would we please leave his wife alone? There was no need to tie her up. She wasn't going to holler or try to run out of the house. He said she'd been sick for years and years, and she was just beginning to get a little better, but an incident like this might cause her to have a setback. I know it's nothing to laugh over. Only I couldn't help it. Him talking about a setback. Next thing, I brought the boy down. First, I put him in the room with his dad. Tied his hands to an overhead steam pipe. Then I figured that wasn't very safe. He might somehow get loose and undo the old man, or vice versa. So I cut him down and took him to the playroom, where there was a comfortable-looking couch. I roped his feet to the foot of the couch, roped his hands, then carried the rope up and made a loop around his neck, so if he struggled, he'd choke himself. Once, while I was working, I put the knife down on this... Well, it was a freshly varnished cedar chest. The whole cellar smelled of varnish, and he asked me not to put my knife there. The chest was a wedding present he'd built for somebody. A sister, I believe he said. Just as I was leaving, he had a coughing fit, so I stuffed a pillow under his head. Then I turned off the lights.
Dewey says, but you hadn't taped their mouths?
No. The taping came later, after I'd tied both the women in their bedrooms. Mrs. Clutter was still crying. At the same time, she was asking me about Dick. She didn't trust him, but said she felt I was a decent young man. I'm sure you are, she says, and made me promise I wouldn't let Dick hurt anybody. I think what she really had in mind was her daughter. I was worried about that myself. I suspected Dick was plotting something. Something I wouldn't stand for. When I finished tying Mrs. Clutter, sure enough, I found he'd taken the girl to her bedroom. She was in the bed and he was sitting on the edge of it, talking to her. I stopped that. I told him to go look for the safe while I tied her up. After he'd gone, I roped her feet together and tied her hands behind her back. Then I pulled up the covers, tucked her in until just her head showed. There was a little easy chair near the bed, and I thought I'd rest a minute. My legs were on fire. All that climbing and kneeling. I asked Nancy if she had a boyfriend. She said yes, she did. She was trying hard to act casual and friendly. I really liked her. She was really nice. A very pretty girl, and not spoiled or anything. She told me quite a lot about herself. About school, and how she was going to go to a university to study music and art. Horses. Said next to dancing, what she liked best was to gallop a horse, so I mentioned my mother had been a champion rodeo rider. And we talked about Dick. I was curious, see, what he'd been saying to her. Seems she'd asked him why he did things like this. Rob people. And wow. Did he toss her a tearjerker? Said he'd been raised an orphan in an orphanage, and how nobody had ever loved him, and his only relative was a sister who lived with men without marrying them. All the time we were talking, we could hear the lunatic roaming around below, looking for the safe, looking behind pictures, tapping the walls, tap, 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 like some nutty woodpecker. When he came back, just to be a real bastard, I asked, had he found it? Of course he hadn't, but he said he'd come across another purse in the kitchen. With $7.
Dunce says, how long now had you been in the house?
Maybe an hour.
Dunce says, and when did you do the taping?
Right then.
started with Mrs. Clutter. I made Dick help me, because I didn't want to leave him alone with the girl. I cut the tape in long strips, and Dick wrapped them around Mrs. Clutter's head like he'd wrap a mummy. He asked her, "How come you keep on crying? Nobody's hurting you." And he turned off the bedside lamp and said, "Good night, Mrs. Clutter. Go to sleep." Then he says to me, as we're heading along the hall toward Nancy's room, "I'm gonna bust that little girl." And I said, "Uh-huh. But you'll have to kill me first." He looked like he didn't believe he'd heard right. He says, "What do you care? Hell, you can bust her too." Now that's something I despise. Anybody that can't control themselves sexually. Christ, I hate that kind of stuff. I told him straight, "Leave her alone, else you've got a buzzsaw to fight." That really burned him, but he realized it wasn't the time to have a flat-out free-for-all. So he says, "Okay, honey, if that's the way you feel." The end of it was we never even taped her. We switched off the hall light and went down to the basement. Perry hesitates. He has a question but phrases it as a statement. I'll bet he never said anything about wanting to rape the girl. Dewey admits it, but he adds that except for an apparently somewhat expurgated version of his own conduct, Hickok's story supports Smith's. The details vary, the dialogue is not identical, but in substance, the two accounts, thus far at least, corroborate one another. Maybe. But I knew he hadn't told about the girl. I'd have bet my shirt. Dunt says, "Perry, I've been keeping track of the lights. The way I calculate it, when you turned off the upstairs light, that left the house completely dark."
Did. And we never used the lights again. Except the flashlight.
Dick carried the flashlight when we went to tape Mr. Clutter and the boy. Just before I taped him, Mr. Clutter asked me, and these were his last words. Wanted to know how his wife was, if she was all right. And I said she was fine. She was ready to go to sleep. And I told him it wasn't long till morning, and how in the morning somebody would find them. And then all of it, me and Dick and all, would seem like something they dreamed. I wasn't kidding him. I didn't want to harm the man. I thought he was a very nice gentleman. Soft-spoken. I thought so right up to the moment I cut his throat. Wait. I'm not telling it the way it was. Perry scowls. He rubs his legs. The handcuffs rattle. After we'd taped them, Dick and I went off in a corner. To talk it over. Remember now, there were hard feelings between us. Just then it made my stomach turn to think I'd ever admired him. Lapped up all that brag. I said, "Well, Dick, any qualms?" He didn't answer me. I said, "Leave them alive, and this won't be any small rap. 10 years, the very least." He still didn't say anything. He was holding the knife. I asked him for it, and he gave it to me. And I said, "All right, Dick, here goes." But I didn't mean it. I meant to call his bluff. Make him argue me out of it. Make him admit he was a phony and a coward. See, it was something between me and Dick. I knelt down beside Mr. Clutter. And the pain of kneeling. I thought of that goddamn dollar. Silver dollar. The shame. Disgust. And they'd told me never to come back to Kansas. But I didn't realize what I'd done till I heard the sound. Like somebody drowning. Screaming underwater. I handed the knife to Dick. I said, "Finish him. You'll feel better." Dick tried. Or pretended to. But the man had the strength of 10 men. He was half out of his ropes. His hands were free. Dick panicked.
Dick wanted to get the hell out of there. But I wouldn't let him go. The man would have died anyway, I know that. But I couldn't leave him like he was. I told Dick to hold the flashlight. Focus it. Then I aimed the gun. The room just exploded. Went blue. Just blazed up. Jesus. I'll never understand why they didn't hear the noise 20 miles around. Dewey's ears ring with it, a ringing that almost deafens him to the whispery rush of Smith's soft voice. But the voice plunges on, ejecting a fusillade of sounds and images. Hickok hunting the discharged shell, hurrying, hurrying, and Kenyon's head in a circle of light, the murmur of muffled pleadings, then Hickok again scrambling after a used cartridge. Nancy's room. Nancy listening to boots on hardwood stairs, the creak of the steps as they climb toward her. Nancy's eyes. Nancy watching the flashlight's shine seek the target. She said, "Oh, no. Oh, please. No. 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 Don't. Oh, please, don't. Please." I gave the gun to Dick. I told him I'd done all I could do. He took aim, and she turned her face to the wall. The dark hall, the assassins hastening toward the final door. Perhaps, having heard all she had, Bonnie welcomed their swift approach. That last shell was a bitch to locate. Dick wiggled under the bed to get it. Then we closed Mrs. Clutter's door and went downstairs to the office. We waited there, like we had when we first came. Looked through the blinds to see if the hired man was poking around, or anybody else who might have heard the gunfire. But it was just the same. Not a sound. Just the wind. And Dick, panting like wolves were after him. Right there, in those few seconds before we ran out to the car and drove away, that's when I decided I'd better shoot Dick. He'd said over and over. He'd drummed it into me. No witnesses. And I thought, he's a witness. I don't know what stopped me. God knows I should have done it. Shot him dead. Got in the car and kept on going till I lost myself in Mexico. A hush. For 10 miles and more, the three men ride without speaking. Sorrow and profound fatigue are at the heart of Dewey's silence. It had been his ambition to learn exactly what happened in that house that night. Twice now he'd been told, and the two versions were very much alike, the only serious discrepancy being that Hickok attributed all four deaths to Smith, while Smith contended that Hickok had killed the two women. But the confessions, though they answered questions of how and why, failed to satisfy his sense of meaningful design. The crime was a psychological accident, virtually an impersonal act. The victims might as well have been killed by lightning. Except for one thing. They had experienced prolonged terror. They had suffered. And Dewey could not forget their sufferings. Nonetheless, he found it possible to look at the man beside him without anger, with rather a measure of sympathy. For Perry Smith's life had been no bed of roses, but pitiful, an ugly and lonely progress toward one mirage and then another. Dewey's sympathy, however, was not deep enough to accommodate either forgiveness or mercy. He hoped to see Perry and his partner hanged. Hanged back to back. Dunce asks Smith, "Add it up. How much money did you get from the Clutters?" "Between $40 and $50. Among Garden City's animals are two gray tomcats who are always together. Thin, dirty strays with strange and clever habits. The chief ceremony of their day is performed at twilight. First, they trot the length of Main Street, stopping to scrutinize the engine grills of parked automobiles, particularly those stationed in front of the two hotels, the Windsor and Warren. For these cars, usually the property of travelers from afar, often yield what the bony, methodical creatures are hunting. Slaughtered birds. Crows, chickadees, and sparrows foolhardy enough to have flown into the path of oncoming motorists. Using their paws as though they are surgical instruments, the cats extract from the grills every feathery particle. Having cruised Main Street, they invariably turn the corner at Main and Grant, then lope along toward Courthouse Square, another of their hunting grounds, and a highly promising one on the afternoon of Wednesday, January 6th, for the area swarmed with Finney County vehicles that had brought to town part of the crowd populating the square. The crowd started forming at 4 o'clock, the hour that the county attorney had given as the probable arrival time of Hickok and Smith. Since the announcement of Hickok's confession on Sunday evening, newsmen of every style had assembled in Garden City. Representatives of the major wire services, photographers, newsreel and television cameramen, reporters from Missouri, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Texas, and of course, all the principal Kansas papers. 20 or 25 men altogether. Many of them had been waiting 3 days without much to do except interview the service station attendant James Spohr, who, after seeing published photographs of the accused killers, had identified them as customers to whom he'd sold $3.06 worth of gas the night of the Holcomb tragedy. It was the return of Hickok and Smith that these professional spectators were on hand to record, and Captain Gerald Murray of the Highway Patrol had reserved for them ample space on the sidewalk fronting the courthouse steps. The steps the prisoners must mount on their way to the county jail, an institution that occupies the top floor of the four-story limestone structure. One reporter, Richard Parr of the Kansas City Star, had obtained a copy of Monday's Las Vegas Sun. The paper's headline raised rounds of laughter. Fear lynch mob awaiting return of killer suspects. Captain Murray remarked, "Don't look much like a necktie party to me." Indeed, the congregation in the square might have been expecting a parade or attending a political rally. High school students, among them former classmates of Nancy and Kenyon Clutter, chanted cheerleader rhymes, bubbled bubblegum, gobbled hot dogs and soda pop. Mothers soothed wailing babies. Men strode about with young children perched on their shoulders. The Boy Scouts were present, an entire troop. And the middle-aged membership of a women's bridge club arrived en masse. Mr. J.P., Jap Adams, head of the local Veterans Commission office, appeared, attired in a tweed garment so oddly tailored that a friend yelled, "Hey, Jap, what you doing wearing ladies' clothes?" For Mr. Adams, in his haste to reach the scene, had unwittingly donned his secretary's coat. A roving radio reporter interviewed sundry other townsfolk, asking them what, in their opinion, the proper retribution would be for the doers of such a dastardly deed. And while most of his subjects said gosh or gee whiz, one student replied, "I think they ought to be locked in the same cell for the rest of their lives. Never allowed any visitors. Just sit there staring at each other till the day they die." And a tough, strutty little man said, "I believe in capital punishment. It's like the Bible says, an eye for an eye. And even so, we're 2 pair short." As long as the sun lasted, the day had been dry and warm. October weather in January. But when the sun descended, when the shadows of the square's giant shade trees met and combined, the coldness as well as darkness numbed the crowd. Numbed and pruned it. By 6 o'clock, fewer than 300 persons remained. Newsmen, cursing the undue delay, stamped their feet and slapped frozen ears with ungloved, freezing hands. Suddenly, a murmuring arose on the south side of the square. The cars were coming. Although none of the journalists anticipated violence, several had predicted shouted abuse. But when the crowd caught sight of the murderers, with their escort of blue-coated highway patrolmen, it fell silent, as though amazed to find them humanly shaped. The handcuffed men, white-faced and blinking blindly, glistened in the glare of flash bulbs and floodlights. The cameramen, pursuing the prisoners and the police into the courthouse and up three flights of stairs, photographed the door of the county jail slamming shut. No one lingered, neither the press corps nor any of the townspeople. Warm rooms and warm suppers beckoned them, and as they hurried away, leaving the cold square to the two gray cats, the miraculous autumn departed too. The year's first snow began to fall. Part 4. The Corner. Institutional dourness and cheerful domesticity coexist on the fourth floor of the Finney County Courthouse. The presence of the county jail supplies the first quality, while the so-called sheriff's residence, a pleasant apartment separated from the jail proper by steel doors and a short corridor, accounts for the second. In January 1960, the sheriff's residence was not, in fact, occupied by the sheriff, Earl Robinson, but by the undersheriff and his wife, Wendell and Josephine Josie Meyer. The Meyers, who had been married more than 20 years, were very much alike. Tall people with weight and strength to spare, with wide hands, square and calm and kindly faces, the last being most true of Mrs. Meyer, a direct and practical woman who nevertheless seems illuminated by a mystical serenity. As the undersheriff's helpmate, her hours are long, between 5 in the morning, when she begins the day by reading a chapter in the Bible, and 10 p.m., her bedtime. She cooks and sews for the prisoners, darns, does their laundry, takes splendid care of her husband, and looks after their 5-room apartment, with its gemütlich melange of plump hassocks and squashy chairs and cream-colored lace window curtains. The Meyers have a daughter, an only child, who is married and lives in Kansas City, so the couple live alone. Or as Mrs. Meyer more correctly puts it, alone except for whoever happens to be in the lady's cell. The jail contains 6 cells. The 6th, the one reserved for female prisoners, is actually an isolated unit situated inside the sheriff's residence. Indeed, it adjoins the Meyers' kitchen. "But," says Josie Meyer, "that don't worry me. I enjoy the company. Having somebody to talk to while I'm doing my kitchen work." Most of these women, you got to feel sorry for them. Just met up with old man trouble is all. Course Hickok and Smith was a different matter. Far as I know, Perry Smith was the first man ever stayed in the ladies' cell. The reason was the sheriff wanted to keep him and Hickok separated from each other until after their trial. The afternoon they brought them in, I made 6 apple pies and baked some bread and all the while kept track of the goings-on down there on the square. My kitchen window overlooks the square. You couldn't want a better view. I'm no judge of crowds, but I'd guess there were several hundred people waiting to see the boys that killed the Clutter family. I never met any of the Clutters myself, but from everything I've ever heard about them, they must have been very fine people. What happened to them is hard to forgive, and I know Wendell was worried how the crowd might act when they caught sight of Hickok and Smith. He was afraid somebody might try to get at them. So I kind of had my heart in my mouth when I saw the cars arrive, saw the reporters, all the newspaper fellas running and pushing. But by then it was dark, after 6, and bitter cold. More than half the crowd had given up and gone home. The ones that stayed, they didn't say boo, only stared. Later, when they brought the boys upstairs, the first one I saw was Hickok. He had on light summer pants and just an old cloth shirt. Surprised he didn't catch pneumonia considering how cold it was. But he looked sick, all right. White as a ghost. Well, it must be a terrible experience. To be stared at by a horde of strangers, to have to walk among them, and them knowing who you are and what you did. Then they brought up Smith. I had some supper ready to serve them in their cells, hot soup and coffee and some sandwiches and pie. Ordinarily, we feed just twice a day. Breakfast at 7:30, and at 4:30 we serve the main meal. But I didn't want those fellas going to bed on an empty stomach. Seemed to me they must be feeling bad enough without that. But when I took Smith his supper, carried it in on a tray, he said he wasn't hungry. He was looking out the window of the lady's cell, standing with his back to me. That window has the same view as my kitchen window. Trees and the square and the tops of houses. I told him, just taste the soup. It's vegetable, and not out of a can. I made it myself. The pie, too. In about an hour, I went back for the tray, and he hadn't touched a crumb. He was still at the window, like he hadn't moved. It was snowing, and I remember saying it was the first snow of the year, and how we'd had such a beautiful long autumn right till then. And now the snow had come. And then I asked him if he had any special dish he liked. If he did, I'd try and fix it for him the next day. He turned round and looked at me, suspicious, like I might be mocking him. Then he said something about a movie. He had such a quiet way of speaking, almost a whisper. Wanted to know if I had seen a movie. I forget the name. Anyway, I hadn't seen it. Never have been much for picture shows. He said this show took place in biblical times, and there was a scene where a man was flung off a balcony, thrown to a mob of men and women who tore him to pieces. And he said that was what came to mind when he saw the crowd on the square, the man being torn apart. And the idea that maybe that was what they might do to him. Said it scared him so bad his stomach still hurt, which was why he couldn't eat. Of course, he was wrong, and I told him so. Nobody was going to harm him, regardless of what he'd done. Folks around here aren't like that. We talked some. He was very shy, but after a while he said, "One thing I really like is Spanish rice." So I promised to make him some, and he smiled, kind of, and I decided, well, he wasn't the worst young man I ever saw. That night, after I'd gone to bed, I said as much to my husband. But Wendell snorted. Wendell was one of the first on the scene after the crime was discovered. He said he wished I'd been out at the clutter place when they found the bodies. Then I could have judged for myself just how gentle Mr. Smith was. Him and his friend Hickok. He said they'd cut out your heart and never bat an eye. There was no denying it. Not with four people dead. And I lay awake wondering if either one was bothered by it. The thought of those four graves. A month passed, and another, and it snowed some part of almost every day. Snow whitened the wheat, tawny countryside, heaped the streets of the town, hushed them. The topmost branches of a snow-laden elm brushed against the window of the lady's cell. Squirrels lived in the tree, and after weeks of tempting them with leftover breakfast scraps, Perry lured one off a branch onto the windowsill and through the bars. It was a male squirrel with auburn fur. He named it Red, and Red soon settled down, apparently content to share his friend's captivity. Perry taught him several tricks. To play with a paper ball, to beg, to perch on Perry's shoulder. All this helped to pass time, but still there were many long hours the prisoner had to lose. He was not allowed to read newspapers, and he was bored by the magazines Mrs. Meyer lent him, old issues of Good Housekeeping and McCall's. But he found things to do. File his fingernails with an emery board, buff them to a silky pink sheen. Comb and comb his lotion-soaked and scented hair. Brush his teeth 3 and 4 times a day. Shave and shower almost as often. And he kept the cell, which contained a toilet, a shower stall, a cot, a chair, a table, as neat as his person. He was proud of a compliment Mrs. Meyer had paid him. "Look," she had said, pointing at his bunk. "Look at that blanket. You could bounce dimes." But it was at the table that he spent most of his waking life. He ate his meals there. It was where he sat when he sketched portraits of Red, drew flowers, and the face of Jesus, and the faces and torsos of imaginary women. And it was where, On cheap sheets of ruled paper, he made diary-like notes of day-to-day occurrences. Thursday, 7 January. Dewey here. Brought carton cigarettes. Also, typed copies of statement for my signature. I declined. The statement, a 78-page document which he had dictated to the Finney County Court stenographer, recounted admissions already made to Alvin Dewey and Clarence Dunce. Dewey, speaking of his encounter with Perry Smith on this particular day, remembered that he had been very surprised when Perry refused to sign the statement. It wasn't important. I could always testify in court as to the oral confession he'd made to Dunce and myself. And, of course, Hickok had given us a signed confession while we were still in Las Vegas, the one in which he accused Smith of having committed all four murders. But I was curious. I asked Perry why he'd changed his mind. And he said, "Everything in my statement is accurate except for two details. If you'll let me correct those items, then I'll sign it." Well, I could guess the items he meant. Because the only serious difference between his story and Hickok's was that he denied having executed the Clutters single-handed. Until now, he'd sworn Hickok killed Nancy and her mother. And I was right. That's just what he wanted to do. Admit that Hickok had been telling the truth, and that it was he, Perry Smith, who had shot and killed the whole family. He said he'd lied about it because, in his words, "I wanted to fix Dick for being such a coward, dropping his guts all over the goddamn floor." And the reason he'd decided to set the record straight wasn't that he suddenly felt any kinder toward Hickok. According to him, he was doing it out of consideration for Hickok's parents. Said he was sorry for Dick's mother. Said she's a real sweet person. It might be some comfort to her to know Dick never pulled the trigger. None of it would have happened without him. In a way, it was mostly his fault, but the fact remains I'm the one who killed them. But I wasn't certain I believed it. Not to the extent of letting him alter his statement. As I say, we weren't dependent on a formal confession from Smith to prove any part of our case. With or without it, we had enough to hang them 10 times over. Among the elements contributing to Dewey's confidence was the recovery of the radio and pair of binoculars the murderers had stolen from the Clutter house and subsequently disposed of in Mexico City, where, having flown there for the purpose, KBI agent Harold Nye traced them to a pawn shop. Moreover, Smith, while dictating his statement, had revealed the whereabouts of other potent evidence. "We hit the highway and drove east," he'd said, in the process of describing what he and Hickok had done after fleeing the murder scene. "Drove like hell. Dick driving. I think we both felt very high. I did. Very high, and very relieved at the same time. Couldn't stop laughing. Neither one of us. Suddenly it all seemed very funny. I don't know why. It just did. But the gun was dripping blood, and my clothes were stained. There was even blood in my hair. So we turned off onto a country road and drove maybe 8 miles till we were way out on the prairie. You could hear coyotes. We smoked a cigarette, and Dick went on making jokes about what had happened back there. I got out of the car and siphoned some water out of the water tank and washed the blood off the gun barrel. Then I scraped a hole in the ground with Dick's hunting knife, the one I used on Mr. Clutter, and buried in it the empty shells and all the leftover nylon cord and adhesive tape. After that, we drove till we came to US 83 and headed east toward Kansas City and Olathe. Around dawn, Dick stopped at one of those picnic places, what they call rest areas, where they have open fireplaces. We built a fire and burned stuff. The gloves we'd worn, and my shirt. Dick said he wished we had an ox to roast. He said he'd never been so hungry. It was almost noon when we got to Olathe. Dick dropped me at my hotel and went on home to have Sunday dinner with his family. Yes, he took the knife with him. The gun, too.
KBI agents, dispatched to Hickok's home, found the knife inside a fishing tackle box and the shotgun still casually propped against a kitchen wall. Hickok's father, who refused to believe his boy could have taken part in such a horrible crime, insisted the gun hadn't been out of the house since the first week in November, and therefore could not be the death weapon. As for the empty cartridge shells, the cord and tape, these were retrieved with the aid of Virgil Peets, a county highway employee who, working with a road grader in the area pinpointed by Perry Smith, shaved away the earth inch by inch until the buried articles were uncovered. Thus, the last loose strings were tied. The KBI had now assembled an unshakable case, for tests established that the shells had been discharged by Hickok's shotgun, and the remnants of cord and tape were of a piece with the materials used to bind and silence the victims.
Monday, 11 January. Have a lawyer. Mr. Fleming, old man with red tie.
Informed by the defendants that they were without funds to hire legal counsel, the court, in the person of Judge Roland H. Tate, appointed as their representatives two local lawyers, Mr. Arthur Fleming and Mr. Harrison Smith. Fleming, 71, a former mayor of Garden City, a short man who enlivens an unsensational appearance with rather conspicuous neckwear, resisted the assignment.
"I do not desire to serve," he told the judge. "But if the court sees fit to appoint me, then of course I have no choice."
Hickok's attorney, Harrison Smith, 45, 6 feet tall, a golfer, an elk of exalted degree, accepted the task with resigned grace.
"Someone has to do it, and I'll do my best. Though I doubt that'll make me too popular around here."
Friday, 15 January. Mrs. Meyer playing radio in her kitchen, and I heard Mann say the county attorney will seek death penalty. The rich never hang, only the poor and friendless.
In making his announcement, the county attorney, Duane West, an ambitious, portly young man of 28 who looks 40 and sometimes 50, told newsmen, "If the case goes before a jury, I will request the jury, upon finding them guilty, to sentence them to the death penalty. If the defendants waive right to jury trial and enter a plea of guilty before the judge, I will request the judge to set the death penalty. This was a matter I knew I would be called upon to decide, and my decision has not been arrived at lightly. I feel that due to the violence of the crime and the apparent utter lack of mercy shown the victims, the only way the public can be absolutely protected is to have the death penalty set against these defendants. This is especially true since in Kansas there is no such thing as life imprisonment without possibility of parole. Persons sentenced to life imprisonment actually serve, on the average, less than 15 years.
Wednesday, 20 January. Asked to take lie detector in regards to this Walker deal.
A case like the Clutter case, crimes of that magnitude, arouse the interest of lawmen everywhere, particularly those investigators burdened with unsolved but similar crimes, for it is always possible that the solution to one mystery will solve another. Among the many officers intrigued by events in Garden City was the sheriff of Sarasota County, Florida, which includes Osprey, a fishing settlement not far from Tampa, and the scene, slightly more than a month after the Clutter tragedy, of the quadruple slaying on an isolated cattle ranch, which Smith had read about in a Miami newspaper on Christmas Day. The victims were again four members of a family, a young couple, Mr. and Mrs. Clifford Walker, and their two children, a boy and a girl, all of whom had been shot in the head with a rifle. Since the Clutter murderers had spent the night of December 19th, the date of the murders, in a Tallahassee hotel, Osprey's sheriff, who had no other leads whatever, was understandably anxious to have the two men questioned and a polygraph examination administered. Hickok consented to take the test, and so did Smith, who told Kansas authorities, "I remarked at the time. I said to Dick, 'I'll bet whoever did this must be somebody that read about what happened out here in Kansas. A nut.'" The results of the test,
to the dismay of Osprey's sheriff as well as Alvin Dewey, who does not believe in exceptional coincidences, were decisively negative. The murderer of the Walker family remains unknown. Sunday, 31 January. Dick's dad here to visit Dick. Said hello when I saw him go past the cell door, but he kept going. Could be he never heard me. Understand from Mrs. M., Meyer, that Mrs. H., Hickok, didn't come because she felt too bad to. Snowing like a bitch. Dreamed last night I was up in Alaska with Dad. Woke up in a puddle of cold urine. Mr. Hickok spent 3 hours with his son. Afterward, he walked through the snow to the Garden City Depot, a work-worn old man, stooped and thinned down by the cancer that would kill him a few months hence. At the station, while waiting for a homeward-bound train, he spoke to a reporter.
I seen Dick. We had a long talk. And I can guarantee you it's not like people say. Or what's put in the papers. Those boys didn't go to that house planning to do violence. My boy didn't. He may have some bad sides, but he's nowhere near bad as that. Smitty's the one. Dick told me he didn't even know it when Smitty attacked the man, Mr. Clutter. Cut his throat. Dick wasn't even in the same room. He only run in when he heard them struggling. Dick was carrying his shotgun, and how he described it was, Smitty took my shotgun and just blew that man's head off. And he says, Dad, I ought to have grabbed back the gun and shot Smitty dead. Killed him before he killed the rest of that family. If I'd done it, I'd be better off than I am now. I guess he would, too. How it is, the way folks feel, he don't stand no chance. They'll hang them both. And, he added, fatigue and defeat glazing his eyes, having your boy hang, knowing he will, nothing worse can happen to a man.
Neither Perry Smith's father nor sister wrote him or came to see him. Tex John Smith was presumed to be prospecting for gold somewhere in Alaska, though lawmen, despite great effort, had been unable to locate him. The sister had told investigators that she was afraid of her brother and requested that they please not let him know her present address. When informed of this, Smith smiled slightly and said, "I wish she'd been in that house that night. What a sweet scene." Except for the squirrel, except for the Myers and an occasional consultation with his lawyer, Mr. Fleming, Perry was very much alone. He missed Dick. Many thoughts of Dick, he wrote one day in his makeshift diary. Since their arrest, they had not been allowed to communicate, and that, freedom aside, was what he most desired. To talk to Dick, be with him again. Dick was not the hard rock he'd once thought him. Pragmatic. Virile, a real brass boy. He'd proven himself to be pretty weak and shallow, a coward. Still, of everyone in all the world, this was the person to whom he was closest at that moment, for they at least were of the same species, brothers in the breed of Cain. Separated from him, Perry felt all by myself, like somebody covered with sores, somebody only a big nut would have anything to do with. But then one mid-February morning, Perry received a letter. It was postmarked Reading, Massachusetts, and it read, "Dear Perry, I was sorry to hear about the trouble you were in, and I decided to write and let you know that I remember you and would like to help you in any way that I can. In case you don't remember my name, Don Cullivan, I've enclosed a picture taken at about the time we met. When I first read about you in the news recently, I was startled, and then I began to think back to those days when I knew you. While we were never close personal friends, I can remember you a lot more clearly than most fellas I met in the Army. It must have been about the fall of 1951 when you were assigned to the 761st Engineer Light Equipment Company at Fort Lewis, Washington. You were short. I'm not much taller. Solidly built. Dark, with a heavy shock of black hair and a grin on your face almost all the time. Since you had lived in Alaska, quite a few of the fellows used to call you Eskimo. One of my first recollections of you was at a company inspection in which all the footlockers were open for inspection. As I recall it, all the footlockers were in order, even yours, except that the inside cover of your footlocker was plastered with pictures of pinup girls. The rest of us were sure you were in for trouble. But the inspecting officer took it in stride, and when it was all over and he let it pass, I think we all felt you were a nervy guy. I remember that you were a fairly good pool player, and I can picture you quite clearly in the company day room at the pool table. You were one of the best truck drivers in the outfit. Remember the Army field problems we went out on? On one trip that took place in the winter, I remember that we each were assigned to a truck for the duration of the problem. In our outfit, Army trucks had no heaters, and it used to get pretty cold in those cabs. I remember you cutting a hole in the floorboards of your truck in order to let the heat from the engine come into the cab. The reason I remember this so well is the impression it made on me, because mutilation of Army property was a crime for which you could get severely punished. Of course, I was pretty green in the Army and probably afraid to stretch the rules even a little bit, but I can remember you grinning about it and keeping warm while I worried about it and froze. I recall that you bought a motorcycle, and vaguely remember you had some trouble with it. Chase by the police? Crack up? Whatever it was the first time I realized the wild streak in you. Some of my recollections may be wrong. This was over 8 years ago, and I only knew you for a period of about 8 months. From what I remember, though, I got along with you very well and rather liked you. You always seemed cheerful and cocky. You were good at your Army work, and I can't remember that you did much griping. Of course, you were apparently quite wild, but I never knew too much about that. But now you were in real trouble. I try to imagine what you were like now. What you think about. When first I read about you, I was stunned. I really was. But then I put the paper down and turned to something else. But the thought of you returned. I wasn't satisfied just to forget. I am, or try to be, fairly religious, Catholic. I wasn't always. I used to just drift along with little thought about the only important thing there is. I never considered death or the possibility of a life hereafter. I was too much alive. Car, college, dating, etc. But my kid brother died of leukemia when he was just 17 years old. He knew he was dying, and afterwards I used to wonder what he thought about. And now I think of you, and wonder what you think about. I didn't know what to say to my brother in the last weeks before he died. But I know what I'd say now. And this is why I am writing you. Because God made you as well as me, and He loves you just as He loves me. And for the little we know of God's will, what has happened to you could have happened to me. Your friend, Don Cullivan. The name meant nothing, but Perry at once recognized the face in the photograph of a young soldier with crew-cut hair and round, very earnest eyes. He read the letter many times. Though he found the religious allusions unpersuasive, I've tried to believe, but I don't. I can't, and there's no use pretending. He was thrilled by it. Here was someone offering help. A sane and respectable man who had once known and liked him, a man who signed himself Friend. Gratefully, in great haste, he started a reply. Dear Don, hell yes, I remember Don Cullivan. Hickok's cell had no window. He faced a wide corridor and the facades of other cells. But he was not isolated. There were people to talk to. A plentiful turnover of drunkards, forgers, wife-beaters, and Mexican vagrants. And Dick, with his light-hearted con-man patter, his sex anecdotes and gamey jokes, was popular with the inmates, though there was one who had no use for him whatever. An old man who hissed at him, "Killer! Killer!" and who once drenched him with a bucket full of dirty scrub water. Outwardly, Hickok seemed to one and all an unusually untroubled young man. When he was not socializing or sleeping, he lay on his cot smoking or chewing gum and reading sports magazines or paperback thrillers. Often he simply lay there whistling old favorites.
You must have been a beautiful baby, shuffle off to Buffalo, and staring at an unshaded light bulb that burned day and night in the ceiling of the cell. He hated the light bulb's monotonous surveillance. It disturbed his sleep and more.